Good afternoon. So last time, we talked about multi-level page tables. So this was our solution to, oh, those big arrays of page table entries are too big. So we need to store less of them somehow. And our solution was this tree structure where we ended up not storing big chunks of page table entries that would all be invalid. And the way we did that is we took our virtual page number. So we had our address, our virtual address, which we divided up into a page offset and a virtual page number, and we further divided that virtual page number into parts. We used the first part for the first level, the next part for the second level, and possibly more parts if we had more than two levels. And the lookup would be that we went to a first level table based on the index for the first level, and then that would point to another table. So we had a bunch of extra tables depending on what first part of the virtual page number we had. And these second tables, if we had two levels, would point to the actual data, just like with our single level case. If we have more than two levels, we have more layers of this same kind of indirection. And the benefit of this scheme, as far as saving space, is that if we didn't have any valid entries in a second level table, we just wouldn't store it. We just store an invalid first level entry to represent that whole swath of invalid second level entries. We also talked about some other things we use page tables to do. So as we originally presented page tables, it seems like, oh, this is just a way for the OS to specify to the processor what memory is accessible to the program and by what addresses. But we actually end up in operating systems using this page table mechanism to support some other features. So one of them was that we wanted to be able to share memory between two programs in a way where we didn't have to worry about one of the programs overwriting that memory. An example of this is if we have two users running, say, Emacs. We want to load the code for Emacs once. But in order to do this safely, we need to know that if one user's Emacs program does something bad, it was not going to overwrite that code and break the other user's Emacs program, because they're kind of supposed to be independent. And page tables, to help us support this, have these extra bits in the page table entries that the processor checks when it's looking at each access that uses that page table entry. And this can be like, do we allow writes using this? Do we allow this to happen in user mode or not? And when the processor's doing the translation, in addition to getting the final physical address to access, it also looks at these permission bits and decides, is this access allowed or not? And if not, it triggers an exception, asks the OS what to do about it. We also mentioned two other examples of things that we can do with page tables that aren't kind of that the page table represents the memory of the program currently idea. So one of them is that because we have this page table mechanism, the operating system doesn't actually need to load all of the program's data in advance. Instead, it can start the program with a page table that's deliberately incomplete. And the program, well, it's going to try to use that. That's not going to work. But the way that doesn't work is it triggers a page fault, an exception, that runs the OS. And that's OS code. That OS code can be like, if this access should have been OK, then make it work. And how do we make it work? We fill in the page tables so it will work, and then we return from that exception, and we're going to be back at that instruction which triggered it, and this time it will work. And we can have this similar idea apply not to just any access but to writes to implement this idea called copy on write. So sometimes we want to share some data between multiple programs that is kind of mostly read. But sometimes it gets written. And when it gets written, we want it to be as if we have separate copies of it. So an example of this is if we have a bunch of global variables with initial values, we might load those initial values from somewhere, but they could change as the program runs. But a lot of the time, most of them won't change. So a way we can handle this is we can load them as read-only, but they're supposed to be writable. But that's okay, because when the program tries to write them, the processor isn't going to crash the program. It's going to trigger an exception and ask the OS what to do. And the OS's code that decides what to do can say, oh, well, this is not really read-only. It's just kind of pretend read-only. So let me make a copy so you're independent of everyone else and let you try that again with this copy. This idea is called copy on write. So questions about things we covered last time? Yes?
How is the padding words, the total number of bits of the virtual page number is not like the number?
How does the padding work?
How is it divided?
So a question is, I talked about us taking a virtual address where we'd have a page offset and a virtual page number, and kind of our assumption is that if we say have three levels, we need to divide this virtual page number into three equal pieces. But what happens if we can't do that? So sometimes this does happen for real processors. In that case, typically what I've seen processors do, but there's other things that would work, is that they'll decide that the first piece here would be smaller than the other pieces, and they'll just say the first level table is small. So they'll have different sizes for tables at different levels to handle that. Yes?
Did the allocate and demand give like the OS allocate a page which is less than the page size?
Question, for allocate on demand, can the OS allocate a page that's less than the page size? No, because when we tell the processor about that page, the way we do it is by filling in a page table entry. And there's nowhere in the page table entry to say only part of this page is valid. We can only say the whole thing's valid or the whole thing's invalid. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, so I guess how does allocate on demand help us save space?
So the question is, how does allocate on demand help us save space if we have to allocate whole pages? So that we have to allocate whole pages is something, a problem that we have without allocate on demand, right? So if we're allocating everything in advance, we'd still have to allocate whole pages. That's the smallest unit we can allocate with page tables. With allocate on demand, the hope is that if the program doesn't use all the space that it was promised, that we don't actually assign that space. Or even if it does, maybe we're faster because we don't allocate that space before we start it. We can allocate it sort of while it's getting started. Does that answer your question? Question, would that just mean setting the valid bit? What do you mean by that?
So like if we have entries which we're not using, for those would we just set the valid bit to zero?
Question, if we have entries that we're not using, would we just set the valid bit for those to zero? Yes. And note that in the multi-level table, sometimes we'll just set a valid bit to zero in the first level because we don't need any of the second level entries. Does that answer your question? Okay, yes.
If you allocate a full page, and then you don't use all of it, for every time you try to access it using the offset for the lower half of the page that you don't use, would that throw an error?
If you allocate a whole page but don't use all of it, if you access the other parts of it, would it throw an error? The answer is no, because as far as the processor is concerned, it knows how to access the whole thing, it has an address it can access, and it's going to access that address. So if an operating system wants to catch program accesses on a granularity finer than a page. So as a concrete example, let's say you wanted to detect array out of bounds errors consistently. That seems like a great idea. With page tables, well, sorry, you can't, because the best you can do is you can make these page size units accessible work or not. If you want to do smaller, you'll need to do something completely different. And if you've used address sanitizer is an example of a completely different way of doing that sort of thing, which is a lot slower because it doesn't have as much help from the hardware. Does that answer your question? Yes?
Would allocate on demand, you allocate a page, and then all of the entries in that page are also allocated?
So the question,
or just the page itself?
When you allocate on demand, when you allocate a page, all the entries in that page are allocated, or just the page itself? Okay, so let's be careful about terminology here. So a page is a unit of space. And typically when we talk about allocating on demand, we're allocating a page that's going to store the data for the program. Now, sometimes, in order to point to that page, we'll just be able to update an existing entry in a page table. Sometimes we won't, and we'll have to allocate also a new page table. But that depends on what things are set up beforehand. Does that answer your question? So the question.
If I allocate a page and then I access an entry in that page, does that throw a page fault? Or
So the question is, if I allocate a page and I access an entry in that page, I assume you mean a byte in the page?
Yeah.
Okay. So because we aren't talking about page table entries. Okay. So we got an access a byte in the page, will that trigger a page fault? No. It depends what you mean by allocate. But if by allocate you mean we set up a page table entry for the processor to use, then there's no page faults there, because the reason we have page faults is the processor finds an invalid page table entry or one with permissions that don't work. So it's not going to find one. The access is going to be work as far as not triggering any exceptions. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so let's do some anonymous feedback things. So someone said that they were under the impression that TAs are prioritizing their friends over other students. That definitely shouldn't happen. I can imagine situations that might be misinterpreted as this that weren't this, and I can imagine this also happening. I wasn't there, obviously, because I do not attend most of the office hours. I will look into this. I will say, I would note about the online queue is deliberately not ordered first in, first out. It's ordered based on last time helped. If the online queue is used, like they might be following the queue's order and it's not first in, first out. And they also might be doing things like going back to help someone they didn't finish helping before. But yes, I will look into this sort of thing happening, which definitely should not. And some feedback saying that the homework seems really hard, there's lots of questions on it, office hours were fairly chaotic, and that means the topic wasn't taught well and the instructions weren't clear, maybe. There were certainly things in the instructions which I assume the instructions were tested because they were used in the pilot for the most part, but there were some things which probably should have been clarified, which I edited in the instructions. And I know it didn't help that I'm kind of getting, the autograder has been getting into better shape as far as the feedback it gives. Some of the early feedback was less informative just because I didn't test things that broke in certain ways. And because I had problems with Kaitos, as you noticed last night, that were my fault for not running autograders correctly. But let's talk a little about things in the assignment. And there's, I guess, usually when I cover multi-level page tables, I do a little more examples, so let's do an example there. So some things in the sort of assignment broadly from my time in office hours that sort of are common points of confusion. So some are like sort of high level, what's supposed to be going on here? So translate, that function you're implementing, that's kind of doing the processor's address lookup. That's what you're implementing. And you can follow the lookup diagram from the slides. You're implementing what the processor would do when the program accesses a memory location. Now the problem is, of course, for this to work, you kind of need a page table set up. So where's that happening? That's happening in your page allocate function. And you can think of this page allocate function as being kind of like that as lazy as possible allocate on demand. So we could set up the whole thing all at once, but instead we're going to set it up one page at a time as little as possible. So with page allocate, we're going to give you an address we want you to make work, and you're going to set as few page table entries as you need to make that work. And in the process, Well, you're going to need to allocate page tables. Like, at least the first time, you need to allocate the first page table that the base register points to. And a way you can figure out what you need to allocate is, well, look at what the translate would do, and everything the translate would find needs to be valid. So those are the things you might need to change. And note that it needs to handle initializing the page table. So I said you only need to set it apart for that access to work. This is true. But a common thing people miss is that if I access something else that's not supposed to be valid yet, well, the only way the translate function is going to know it's not valid yet is if you've marked it as not valid. Otherwise, the translate function might think it is valid. And that could cause you problems later. So another sort of high-level thing that caused a lot of confusion is how big virtual addresses are. Because people looked at the function and said, oh, translate takes a size t, and size t in our systems is 8 bytes, so virtual addresses are 64 bits, right? And that's not what we're doing. So remember we talked about how the size of pointers and the size of the virtual address that's used in the translation can be different. And in this assignment, that's the case. Now you might say, wait a moment, in the assignment we didn't tell you how big the virtual address part is. Well, we didn't tell you directly. But we said some things that kind of require it to be of a limited size. And that's that, well, our page tables are only so big. And the way we're going to do the lookup is we're going to take parts of the address, use them to index into the page tables. And if our page tables only have so many indexes, that limits how big those parts of the address can be. So that's how you can figure out how much of the address is actually used for the translation. So questions on these sort of general things with the assignment or other things about assignment? Yes?
Why is it, I guess, convenient that page table and page size are the same?
Question, why is it convenient that page table and page size are the same? The biggest reason is that if you think of implementing page allocate, that if I want to allocate a space for a new page table or allocate space for a new page of data, same code. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so let's go through a little example of a two-level page table lookup. This was the other thing which seemed to be causing confusion with the assignment. What really happens in a two-level page table? So here I have a contents of physical memory where page tables have already been set up apparently. And this is my toy example, so I have 8-byte pages, because if I used like 4,096-byte pages, probably wouldn't fit on the slide very well. So our physical pages are this, these 8 bytes, these 8 bytes, these 8 bytes, and so on. And our page table base register is 20, which means that our first level page table takes up these 8 bytes. I know it's 8 bytes because it's one page, and page tables are one page according to the question. So that those 8 bytes there starting at 20, that is our first level page table in this example. And this example asks us to translate the virtual address 131, which I'm told is a 9-bit address. So we can write that out. I'll go through here as binary, and we need to split that address up into a page offset and our parts of our virtual page number. And because we have 8-byte pages, our page offset is going to be these last 3 bits. This is our page offset. The rest is our virtual page number. And in our page tables, in this example, there are 8 bytes, and the page table entries are 1 byte, so there's 8 entries. So I need 3 bits to refer to one of those entries. Another way I can think of this is if I count how many indices I have on my page table, I have 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. that's 000 to 111. So I need 3 bits to represent each part. And we always start at the most significant bit for our first level. So we have the highlighted bits 100, or the value 4, as the first part of our virtual page number. And then I do an array lookup. So an array lookup, I take the start of my array, 20, add the index times the size of each array element, which is 1 byte in this case. So I get address 24. I see that I have D4 there. So I have the value, and I decode it according to the page table format I'm given, which in this case, a bit different than our assignment, is that we have 3 bits for a physical page number and then a valid bit, and then a bunch of unused bits. So I can decode this as physical page number 110 and a valid bit of 1. The valid bit's 1, we keep going. So questions about how I did this first step? Yeah. Question that multiplication of 4 times 1, that's also hex. In this case, it doesn't matter because I would write it the same way if it was decimal.
But if it does matter, then it would still be hex, right?
If it does matter, it would still be hex. It matters that you use the right numerical value. In this case, I wrote the result in hex, and that's the important part. Other questions? Okay, so then we take, yeah.
Could you explain how you got the 0x24?
Can I explain how I got the 0x24? Sure. So this is an array lookup. Our array starts at address 20, because that's the page table base register. And I want index 4, because that was my virtual page number part. And each array element is 1 byte. So this is the sort of size of array element. So the 4 is this first part of the virtual page number part, this 100. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Can I explain how I broke up the value of the virtual address?
Like PT1,
like 0x4. Oh. Can I explain how I broke up D4 here into the pieces? I looked up my documentation for what the format of page table entry is, which is on this slide. It's right here. And I compared that to my binary. So my binary had 11010100, and the most significant bit is at the beginning of that. And my documentation says I have 3 bits at the most significant bit, which is my physical page number, 110, then a valid bit. Does that answer your question? Yeah?
So at the end of the 0x131, you have the 001, which is box of PO. Is that telling you that you moved down from the 0x23 to the 0x247? Is that what that
is? Question is about the box around the 001. Question, what does that mean? So that's something we're going to use in the last step. So that's where in the page we're going to find at the end is the value we want. But we haven't gotten to the end, we've just done the first step, so we're not there. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah, sorry, I should be looking, yeah. What is the PPM 110 part? This was extracted from the page table entry that we got. And that's the physical page number that was stored in that page table entry. And this is acting as a pointer to the next page table. So we'll see in our next step, we're basically going to repeat this process. But rather than using the page table base register, we're going to take that physical page number, and that's going to tell us where to start. And rather than using the first part of the virtual page number, we're going to use the second part. So what we'll end up with is that we'll turn our physical page number, 110, into this starting address. I did that by just adding a page offset of 0. and then add my offset, which in this case I've copied from the address in binary, to do my array lookup. So I'm doing another page table lookup, but this time my page table starts at address, this is 30. So that is, this is my second level page table here. And I got that because this is physical page number 6, which is the 110 that I got from that first page table entry. So we can think of what happened here is that we had in this page table entry, it pointed to that second level page table, and I followed that pointer. The pointer was stored in a kind of funny way because it stored the physical page number, but that's what I just did. I just followed that pointer to get to the second array of page table entries, and now I'm doing a lookup in that array to get the element based on the second part of the virtual page number. Yes? So the question is the 110000, the physical page number multiplied by the page offset, is the physical page number multiplied by the page size, which is equivalent to forming an address by taking our physical page number and adding a page offset piece and putting zeros in that page offset piece. Yes? So the question is, everything from 2.0 to 2F is the first level page table?
Yeah.
That's the first part. It's just these 8 bytes, and I know that because I'm told how big page tables are. They're one page, and a page is only 8 bytes.
What is the middle part?
And so the question is, what is this middle part then? This middle part is some other page. Could be used for data, could be used for page tables. We don't know from the information here. Question is, if it was only one level, we'd only have this first part, and whatever's in here would be the physical address. I would say it would be the page we'd go to get the full physical address. We need the rest of the address, the page itself. Does that answer your question? Okay, back there.
So this is like a three-level page lookup, where we take, the physical page number found from the second, from the level 2 lookup, had the offset with 0, and this is from the
Question, if this was a three-level lookup, would we take the page number found in the second part and use that for another copy of that, basically, or?
To go to the level 3 lookup.
To go to the level 3 lookup? Absolutely. So, yes?
So, could you just explain how you got from, D4 pointing to, the 0x30 physical address part?
Quick question. How did I figure out that D4 points to this 0x30 part? So, this D4 entry, when we decoded it, it contained this physical page number, which is 6. Our pages are 8 bytes, so that is 6 times 8 bytes is the address of that, which is 30. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Yeah. Question is, from 0x131, how did they get this 4?
Yeah.
So I know that I have 8 things in each page table. So I need 3 bits to represent that. So it's the first 3 bits of the part of the virtual address.
Okay. But for the page offset, was it 0x01? Would you just look at index 1 instead?
Okay. Question, for the page offset, wouldn't I look at index 1? Yes, we're going to do that later. Where you process the address from most significant part to least significant part. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Yes, back there.
After the red 110, did that come from the same spot as the higher bit 110 reconversion?
Question, did this red 110 here come from the same thing that this 110 came from?
No, the 110.
This, the 110 that's also in red? Yes. Yeah. How did I get the 000 in the red box? I had a page number, and I did a page at physical address. And if you remember how our addresses work, If I have an address, I can split that up into a page offset and a page number. So I'm just doing the reverse of that process. I have a page number, I need a physical address, so I'm going to add a page offset. And that page offset's going to be zero since I want to start at the beginning of the page. Does that answer your question? Yes, back there. Wait, way back. Yeah.
How did you get the page offset? Just did not understand page offset.
How did I get the page offset? Which page offset? How did I know the page offset was 3 bits? I knew it because pages are 8 bytes. I need 3 bits to determine which of 8 bytes I'm referring to because I want to go 0 to 7. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. And
how come they're both 110?
How come they're both 110? Just a coincidence. They come from different places. Yes. Question, will always be the case that the rest of your virtual address will evenly divide in the numbers level you have? If your all your page tables are the same size, yes. They are, maybe not. Okay, other questions? Okay, so let me do our, so we get our next step, and we got that our next page table entry here is DB, and we're gonna decode that. And the coding's actually the same as before. So this page table entry actually points to, I'll use a different color, this page table entry here actually points to the same part of memory. And you might say, isn't that a problem? Well, no, it isn't. We're allowed to do that. The processor knows what we want to access. Does this make sense for a program? Probably not. This would mean a program could access part of its own page table. On the other hand, if we're thinking of the OS can also access the page tables, and an easy way to do it. So this is how it would set. So you would have this set, sort of thing set up. This is letting us access the page table with a virtual address. So in this case, it points to the same page, and to get the final address, we're going to combine that page number we got with the page offset from the original address. We're finally going to use that one. And we figure out where we want to access memory, and it's going to be at address 31, so we finally get this value 0A is the thing we're going to access reading or writing. And I have a color-coded shell version of this diagram here. Where, yes, the things that are the same color are for the same purpose, from the same place. Okay, so questions or sort of overall look up here. Yes?
The 110 and purple, why did that come from all the way up there?
Why did the 110 and purple come from all the way up there? So if we think of the first step, we took this 100 and used it to do an array index lookup here. We're going to use the next part to do another array index lookup. And we can also kind of even view this last part as another array index lookup, right? So we're basically doing array lookups for each piece of the address in sequence. Does that answer your question? Yes. The question is, for the assignment, will the virtual addresses we're providing have enough bits? So if you mean, will they fit in the size T, yes. If that's what you mean. And this is because we say in the assignment that we're not going to set the config.h value such that the address would end up being too big. Does that answer your question? The question is, will there be enough virtual page number bits? So there'll be enough bits in the value we provide you to like get all the parts of the virtual page number based on the config values. Now, the leading bits there might be zeros, but there will be enough of them. Yes?
Where do you get the 32 bits?
Where did I get the 31, this final number? That is this converted to this binary value converted to hex. And this hex value comes from a page table entry we looked up in the second step, plus the page offset we got from the original address. So at the end of it, we got the physical page number where the program's data really is stored, but we don't want the beginning of that page. We want somewhere in the middle based on what address we selected, and that final 3-1 is doing that step. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other follow-ups, other questions? Okay, so for the remainder of the class, we're going to talk about networking, which some stuff we want to get to because there's a lab tomorrow. Not that much, so we'll manage it. So but in CS01, you did stuff with sockets. So we're going to talk about sort of things that are happening underneath sockets. And in sockets, you have this model of networks, which is kind of much nicer than what networks really see. So we're going to talk about a model of how networks work, where rather than opening a connection and sending a stream of data that all goes together from one place to another, what we can do is we can send kind of letter-type things. That we have an operation where we can send something to a machine, and a machine can receive something, and the network will handle sending that something. But there's no connection here. There's no like stream of data. We can only send one thing at a time. And the network is providing the functionality that it knows how to get a message to B if we ask to go to B. It's not providing functionality like make sure we have a connection with B, put all these things together as a stream of stuff. No, we're just sending a message. We can send multiple messages, but they're independent. There's no relationship between them that the network knows about. All it knows about is it's sending letters. And we might call this the mailbox model because it's kind of like sending letters in the mail, that if you send a bunch of letters, they're not necessarily going to be sent together. They'll go to the right place, and the network's kind of providing our sort of mail functionality, that we can send this letter to B, and it will get there. But if we want to have this be like a connection, where we have like a bunch of things that we're sending over time, we're going to need to kind of build that on top of this much more simple functionality where all the network knows how to do is send stuff from one place to another. And kind of in this model, we'll have sort of an outbox for mail. So we'll have a bunch of messages waiting to go on the network. And there will be a bunch of messages that machine B has received that it's going to process in some order and send to programs. So questions about this sort of mailbox model for what our network is going to provide us and how it's like not as much as what you saw with sockets. Okay, so the internet, sort of the big thing it provides, the infrastructure of the internet, is this mailbox style communication. That you can send messages to a particular mailbox, a machine. There's no actual guarantee on order when received, and we're going to somehow implement sockets on top of this. And we're going to talk about how we do that. And remember, sockets, sort of as a refresher, like you can connect to a remote server, that server can accept your connection, and then we can send things back and forth over and over again, and it's sort of all tied together, you know, and it's reliable, and it kind of looks like, you know, you have a remote terminal, like is kind of the interface that program gets. So that you read and write just like it is a terminal file, you know, rather than having to worry about dividing your stuff up into messages and everything else, and some other problems we'll see with how limited that mailbox model is. Questions on this functionality of sockets. Okay. So the way network stuff works is kind of, there's stuff that's built on top of other stuff that's built on top of other stuff. So there's these commonly called layers. And there's different pictures you'll get of layers. I'm going to use this one. That we have some physical layer. We have some implementation that knows how to place bits on some medium, as I'll call it, which could be a wire or could be in radio signals. But that's not actually what we use even when we're doing this sort of mailbox thing, right? That doesn't provide send a message to a machine functionality. So we have some stuff built on top of that that gets us closer to that. And the first layer I have here is called the link layer. And this is things like Ethernet or Wi-Fi. And this provides the send a message to a machine functionality, but only for machines that are on the same network. Like for Wi-Fi that are in radio range of you, or for Ethernet that are physically plugged into the same Ethernet cable or a switch that's plugged into this that the other machine's also plugged into. So if we want to get to machines which are where we have to do more steps to get to them, we need something else. And there's something that's built on top of this thing which handles getting local messages, which we call a network layer. And this includes the Internet Protocol, version 4 and version 6. And this is about reaching the correct machine across networks. And on top of that functionality, we build the things you're used to in sockets. So most notably with TCP, the Transport Control Protocol, which is in the transport layer in our taxonomy here. And this handles reaching the correct program. So this mailbox model is about reaching the right machine, but there might be multiple programs. So we need to decide that somehow. And also it handles making things into reliable and variable streams. So it turns out that the mailbox model, not only do we have to send things as separate messages, but sometimes they don't get there. And one of the things our transport layer will handle is dealing with that. And also will handle dividing them up into separate messages so we can have a big stream of data and not have to worry about, you know, if I'm sending a megabyte of stuff, how was that divided into messages? Okay. So questions about sort of these layers we're going to deal with before, and our next topic just is going to be as highlighted. We're going to talk about, well, basically what are we doing to get from this mailbox model to something like your sockets? What do we have to do over the network to make that work? So questions? Okay, so as I alluded to, the version of sort of our mailbox model that the network layer that we use on the internet provides is not reliable. So there are things, limitations it imposes on our messages that are going to make it not completely straightforward to implement something where we, you know, it provide that sort of connection functionality you saw with sockets. And I have sort of a list of things that can happen to messages on the network that we will need to deal with. So one of them is messages can be lost. So like a letter lost in the mail, this happens occasionally. Yes, it's not going to happen most of the time, or else your network will not be very usable. But if we think of how making connections, if only one out of 10,000 of the messages are lost, and we're running a web browser for an hour, you're going to need to deal with it. Especially because it's going to turn out that our messages are typically like a kilobyte. So if we're downloading a gigabyte in kilobyte pieces, then we'll have plenty of opportunity for messages to be lost, even if it's relatively uncommon. And similarly, we can have some other things that happen to our messages. So one is that our messages can be delayed or reordered. So sometimes the network will send some messages faster than others. There's a bunch of reasons this could happen. So one is that, let's say, you know, I have two ways my network can get the data to you. It could try either of them, and they'll have different speeds. Another way is that we'll see that we're going to have ways of dealing with the first problem, messages being lost, that involve sending messages again. And there can be a side effect of other parts of the network doing that, that the messages might be delayed or reordered. Another issue we have is that messages are limited in size. So I said we typically are going to divide up into kilobyte chunks, and this is because the infrastructure of the internet, if you're sending more than around 1,500 bytes, it's probably just going to say no. You have to make it smaller. Sorry. And a last problem we have is that very occasionally, our messages will get corrupted. And it kind of makes sense that this could happen. If we think of Wi-Fi, well, the radio is not 100%, so sometimes, you know, the message won't be lost, but we'll seem to get the message, but it will be, something will be wrong with it because of, like, radio problems, for example. And we can have similar issues with, like, a bad cable or something like that, or faulty networking gear. And there's lots of machines on the way, so there's lots of opportunities for our message to get corrupted. And again, I'm talking about these things sort of as things we need to deal with, but we're not saying I need to deal with them because they're common. They probably aren't. But if we're downloading a gigabyte of stuff in 1,000-byte chunks, you know, this is, if we're dealing with something that happens 0.001% of the time, we're going to see these. We're going to have to deal with them. So questions about sort of the types of failures we need to worry about. Okay, so let's start by dealing with the maybe simplest type of failure here to deal with, which is messages being lost. So problem is, let's say, you know, I want to send a message here, which is the meeting's at 12. And what can happen is sometimes the network doesn't deliver that. In our mailbox model. So I delivered, sent my letter to B, the letter got lost. So how could I make sure that B gets the letter? That the meeting is at 12. What should I do? Yeah. Yeah, so have B send back a confirmation. And we're gonna call that confirmation an acknowledgement. So when it sends it back, this is what it looks like. But of course, the interesting case is when it doesn't get it. So when it doesn't get it, we're going to have to do something about it. And what we're going to do is we're going to wait a bit to see if B gets it. And if not, we're going to wait until it's not too long. And then we're going to just send it again. So this is probably the simplest way of dealing with it. You could imagine schemes where instead of having A send it again, we have like B ask for it again or something like that. But someone needs to take action and say, we need to try again, because I didn't get an acknowledgement. Okay, questions? Yes?
What if the acknowledgement gets lost?
What if the acknowledgement gets lost? Yeah, what about that? So that is a good question. That's something that will happen, because the acknowledgement's another message. It can get lost. So before we move on to that, other questions? Or, yeah?
What if you like wait too long to acknowledge it, and then they just assume that you're not acknowledging it?
What if you wait too long to acknowledge it, then they assume that you're not acknowledging it? Do I have that? Yes, I have that. Well, in that case, you'll get it twice. You'll still get it, so it's okay, but yes, you're sending extra stuff. Yeah?
So, I know this isn't likely at all, but in theory, could that result in a message being sent an infinite amount of time that's just never being acknowledged or never being received?
So the question is, couldn't this result in the message being sent an infinite number of times? So something I wasn't explicit about is that, well, you know, if we're timing out the first time, we also could time out the second time, the third time, and we could keep doing that, and we could just send it forever because we don't have any notion of when to give up. And yeah, so with what I've told you, the scheme we have here suggests that, you know, we just keep trying forever. In practice, probably we have a limit. And at some point, we tell whoever's trying to send this message, probably it didn't work. Are we sure it didn't work? No. We're not sure because of this problem. But probably it didn't work. So let's talk about our lost acknowledgement problem. So have four options here for fixing this. What should happen in this scenario? Would like some more time? Okay, so who thinks we should do A? We should have machine A send an acknowledgement of the acknowledgement. Okay, a few people. How about B? That machine B should know to resend this on its own. Some people. How about C? That machine A should resend on its own. How about D? None of these. Okay, so a majority of you chose C, and that I think is the best answer. Let's talk about each of these options. So acknowledging the acknowledgement, that is absolutely a thing we could do. But then we have the same problem again on the acknowledgement of the acknowledgement. So at some point, we're going to have to stop. And usually, people choose to stop after one. But you could stop after two or three, and some systems do that. But at some point, we're going to have to give up and stop acknowledging things and rely on people resending. The idea of having A send the got it on its own, there's a problem here is that if we don't also do the acknowledge the acknowledgement, how does B know to resend that? Because as far as it's concerned, you know, this situation here, as far as all the messages it sees, is exactly the same as the one here. Right? If we think of the messages machine B has gotten, it got this message and no others in this scenario. And in this scenario, it got the same message and no others. It's indistinguishable as far as machine B is concerned. So we need to do something extra for it to tell to resend in this case and not others. And the something extra sounds awful lot like more acknowledgments, but then we kind of have the recursive problem. So probably the easiest solution is resending the immeasurable message. And actually, there's something else about that solution which makes it kind of what we have to do. And that's that if we think about what this situation looks like to machine A, as far as machine A is concerned, it sent a message and received nothing back. That is exactly the same as the scenario where the original message was lost. It sent the message and received nothing back. So machine A doesn't know which of these two scenarios it's in. It doesn't know if it's in this scenario or this scenario. They're indistinguishable to machine A. So machine A has to do the same thing in both cases because it can't tell. It can't. There's no way you can write an if statement depending on which scenario you're in. And this also means that if we're going to give up eventually, machine A, you know, is never going to really be sure if machine B got it, if there's no acknowledgement. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. And that's just an unfortunate, sort of inevitable problem. questions about our lost acknowledgement scenario. Yeah?
So if you're not supposed to send like a got it, then why do they have like their protocol where you can put three-way handshake?
So question, if you're not supposed to send a got it, why does TCP have a three-way handshake? So I said, usually we don't do that. So that is an exception. The three-way handshake does some, so there's TCP, it turns out if you know the details, does something like an acknowledgement, and the question is, why does that happen? And that they decided that that was worth doing to have things set up. But note that they don't do that for every packet, for example, for every piece of the message. They usually use just one acknowledgement. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
Why would machine B just send the same message as machine A sent back? Because what if some of the message machine A sent got lost? Like, what if it's like the meeting is at 1 p.m. when they met his phone?
The question is, what if the message is corrupted? We'll talk about that later as a separate, we'll have a different solution for that. Okay, so our solution for this lost acknowledgement case is that we're going to divide things up. Okay, and I guess we already had the question about what happens if a message is delayed. So if our message is delayed, well, we're gonna end up resending it. So let's say the message is delayed, we might end up resending it when we don't need to. So how do we avoid this? If we set the timeout big enough, this should very rarely happen, but probably we're not going to completely avoid this, you know, all the time. And is this a problem? Well, as long as machine B understands that it doesn't need to process both messages, it should be fine. Yes? So the question is, does machine B send back information on which messages it got? When we have multiple messages to send, we'll get into that, and the answer is yes. Right now we only have one message, so there's no way, got it is there's only one it. Other questions? So if our message is delayed, we'll get an extra acknowledgement, and machine B definitely should do this. It shouldn't try to just assume it sent it once, that's good enough. Because as far as machine B is concerned, the situation is indistinguishable from it sent the first acknowledgement and it got lost, so it needs to send it again. So here we'll have extra acknowledgements. They aren't wasted. It's just because machine B needs to send it just in case the first one got lost, which it looks like it did based on the messages it received. And we'll have the same kind of situation if the acknowledgements are slow. That we might spuriously resend messages, but that's okay, as long as, you know, we'll eventually figure out that, yes, the message got there. We're good. And yeah, we might just might send some extra stuff because we're assuming that we're in the lost message case when we're actually in the delayed message case. So this is kind of a fundamental issue with messages being delayed, that there's no way of distinguishing between a message which was delayed for too long and a message is lost. They're the same thing, as far as you can see on the network. Because the same things came in until you wait too long. Okay, so, yes?
Is there a choose between message you need to select once it gets the one of the confirmations, it'll stop sending all of those kind of messages?
So the question is each?
Like, if machine A says the meeting at 12 p.m., doesn't it, like, the confirmation is delayed, it sends the second one.
So the question is, how do we map from the confirmations to the specific messages that are being confirmed? So in this example, we have one message we're sending, and so we aren't specifying. But we'll see that, yes, we're going to need to specify when we have multiple messages we're sending. And we're going to get into that next when we talk about how we deal with multiple messages being sent. So kind of the simplest way of doing this would be, let's say your messages are limited on size, so we need to divide this message up into multiple pieces. So here I have the meeting and is at 12 p.m. because I can't send the whole thing, that's too big. Obviously in the real net internet, the limit's like 1500 bytes, I'm not gonna write that on the slide. So this seems to work fine. Good. And B can take the two messages it got, put them together, and it reconstructs the meeting is at 12 p.m. Great. So let's apply the same thing we did to deal with like lost messages before. So we send the meeting, our acknowledgement gets lost, we send the meeting again, our acknowledgement doesn't get lost, we send it is at 12 p.m., that works. So B wants to put this message back together, so we're gonna take each of the messages we got and acknowledged, and there we go. The meeting is at 12 p.m. Maybe not optimal here. And this isn't the only type of scenario where we might have issues. So which are some others where we would have problems? You think about that. Yes? Is the 12 p.m. part sent before the meeting part?
Yeah.
So we're assuming in this scenario that, as far as A is concerned, it always sends them in order. Yes?
Couldn't that first part have gotten delayed, though?
Absolutely, and that's item 3 here. So let's go over. Not have much conversation. Which of these do you think? So who thinks, number one, if the message is lost instead of the acknowledgement, who thinks we have the same, have other problems, we get the wrong message reconstructed? Thinks yes? Thinks no? Okay, no clue. Okay, so a mix of no and no clue. I would say no, because as far as, if we look at the messages A gets, A is only gonna get one copy of each message. That should be fine. So this is not a problem for this issue. How about if the first message from A is delayed a long time? That's the scenario our question just alluded to. What if one of them is delayed? In that case, even though A sent them in order, they could be reordered because that first part would be sent received later. And how this might manifest in this situation is that maybe, you know, instead of losing the acknowledgement, we'd end up having the message take a really long time to get there, which machine A would interpret as it got lost, but what really happened is it just got really went really slow, and now we have the meeting is at 12 p.m. the meeting, which is probably not what we wanted. And if the acknowledgement of the second message is lost instead of the first, who thinks that would be another problem where we construct the wrong message? Okay, who thinks it wouldn't be? No clue? Okay, so I think you have a plurality for the wrong message, and I believe so. Basically, we have the scenario we had up here, but with the is 12 p.m. part, and the meeting part would be fine, so we'd end up getting the meeting is at 12 p.m., is at 12 p.m. It's also kind of a messed up result. So what's our fix for this gonna be? Well, the big first thing we need to do is we want to label the parts of the message that are coming out. So we'll mark them as part one and part two, and the term we're gonna see used kind of, if you're reading about TCP, is we'll have like a sequence number that identifies which part we're referring to. And now, when A gets the messages in some arbitrary order, or gets duplicates, it can tell by the part numbers which is which. And it's not going to have to worry about reconstructing the message wrong. So here, it gets the meeting, but it knows, oh, part one again. I only need one copy of part one. I already got it. So we're good. Now, there's a bit of a problem here because I'm still only just saying my acknowledgments are just got it. And it turns out that's not good enough. Why isn't that good enough? Because our acknowledgments can be delayed. So here's an example of where we might get into trouble with that. So in this case, we send the meeting, then machine A says, well, you're taking too long. Here again, the meeting, and we have two acknowledgments. And it happens that the second acknowledgement takes long enough that it gets there after it sends the next part. And it gets confused. It says, oh, got it, great. That was fast. And as far as it's concerned, you got the second part. Because it got an acknowledgement for it. But it's not really an acknowledgement for it. But we just weren't paying. Just the problem is that the only way we had to know what the acknowledgement was for was what we last sent. But that's not really what they're for. So our fix for this is that when we acknowledge things, we're going to say which part we got. And so that way, if we get delayed copies of old acknowledgments, we'll know, okay, that's not relevant. I already got that. We're good. And wait for actually part two to be acknowledged. So questions about our fix here for acknowledging different parts? I guess something to notice here is that we had a timeout for part one, and then we had a separate timeout for part two. We waited for that timeout to expire before we said, okay, I waited too long to get part two to you, let's try again. Yeah. So the question is, would we say how many parts total there are? So it depends on the specifics of the scenario. So if we think of our sockets, we probably wouldn't, because that's when do you close the socket? So there's an arbitrary number of parts. In some other contexts, we might have sort of a fixed number of parts we decide at the beginning. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Yeah. Question, does that mean with a download over network we would have a fixed number of parts to expect? So if we go back to our layers diagram, typically your downloads are implemented by one of these protocols that are built on top of TCP. So built on top of those sockets you've used before. So the answer would be at this transport layer, no, there wouldn't be. And that's because they're built on top of this thing that doesn't really have a pre-published event size. Yes? So a question is, does machine A have to wait for an acknowledgement before it sends each part? No. I have a slide about this. So I've shown examples where you send a message, wait for an acknowledgement. We can instead send a bunch of parts at once. The problem with that, and something you'll learn if you take a networking course, is that we need to do something called congestion control to avoid overloading the network, to figure out how fast can we send. If you take a networking course, they'll talk about how do we figure out how fast we can safely send. Does that answer your question? Okay. So other questions about our splitting messages stuff. Okay, so yes. So the question is, if I send a bunch of messages and I'm expecting to get one acknowledgement for all of them, what happens if I don't receive an acknowledgement for all of them? Typically, the way this works is either you get an acknowledgement for the part just before the last part that was received, let's say we're sending parts 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and we lose part 5, typically you'll either get an acknowledgement for part 4 telling you that part 5 needs to probably be resent, for part 4, which is really part 1 through 4, right? Or you'll get, there'll be some way of writing an acknowledgement which says, I got parts 1 through 4 and 6 through 7. So those are kind of the two options, and they have trade-offs, because one where you just say, I got 1 through 4, I'm waiting for 5, even though you might have gotten 6 or 7, that's easier to implement, obviously. The one where you just say, where you give all the details, like that's a lot more complicated to implement. Does that answer your question? So the question in that case, will you just resend part 5? So you probably resend part 5 and part 6 and part 7. If you said, got an acknowledgement, said, you sent parts 1 through 7, you got an acknowledgement, said, I got everything up to 4. If you're waiting too long, you'll say, okay, I guess 5, 6, and 7 are missing. And you'll resend those, even though maybe they're not. Does that answer your question? Okay, so let's talk about our last 4 minutes, the solution to our last network failure problem, which is messages are corrupting. And the common solution for this is that instead of sending message, we'll send some kind of simple hash function of the message and the message. And when we receive a message, we'll recompute the hash and make sure it matches. If it doesn't match, we'll pretend the message was lost. And we already know how to handle messages being lost, so we'll just reuse all that functionality. And I'm calling this a hash. If you know about TCP or UDP, you might know the term checksum. Checksum is the sort of hash they use, so-called, because they're based on summing up parts of the messages as numbers. Yes?
What do you do in the off chance that the corruption in the hash just so happened, or the corruption in the message also corrupted the hash just in a way where they would still match up while being wrong?
So the question is, isn't it possible that the message could be corrupted so the hash is broken and the message is broken such the hash and message still match? Absolutely. That happens. Hopefully it's very rare. If you care about it, maybe you do more hashes. And this is a reason why you'll sometimes see some application level protocols, example would be BitTorrent, add additional hashes even though TCP is already doing it. Yeah. Question is, how secure do these hashes need to be? So if we are worried about security, this is not where we're going to solve that problem. This is just about, these hashes are about dealing with sort of equipment failures, not about adversaries. If we need to worry about someone maliciously corrupting our messages, we're going to need a completely different class of solutions, which we'll talk about probably in a week or two. So those are our solutions for corruption. So questions about that? Okay, so as I alluded, I showed you sort of the version where we do one message at a time. So what we can do instead is we can send a lot of parts, and have the acknowledgments take a while to come back, and that's okay. And we can also say that if you acknowledge 3, and we can also say that instead of acknowledging each part, maybe you can just say, ACK up to 3, for example. That would be a common way of handling, making this go faster, which you see with the real transfer protocols, where we don't want to send an acknowledgement for every message. We want to do a little less than that. Okay. So questions about this idea of that we can do sort of have multiple messages in flight at once, like going across the network. Okay, so in that case, I guess that's where we finish up for today. So next time we'll talk more about these layers.